It is 7:31, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us back, live in the studios, Paul Leto. Paul Leto is an Everett-based business law and consumer law attorney. He has been on the show a couple times before and has been key in talking about electronic voting and reforms for that, and we're going to be talking about that some more today. Paul, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with a brief overview of the case that you took to court. Last time we talked to you, you and your attorney, Randy Gordon, were right in. And it looks like that case hadn't gone to court yet. You were like ready to go. You were chomping at the bit. I'm wondering, kind of give us an overview of what that case entailed and what has happened since we last talked to you.
Okay, well, basically, the case was an anti-secrecy lawsuit, you might say, or anti-secrecy in elections lawsuit. And basically, it said that you cannot, by signing a contract or by the county signing a contract to purchase voting machines, you can't thereby render the counting of our votes a secret, specifically a trade secret, because the counting of the vote, when it takes place on electronic voting machines, takes place on a corporate hard drive using corporate software that they claim is a trade secret. And one of the elements of trade secrecy is, in order to preserve your secret, you have to keep it secret. So they say, we have to keep it secret in order to preserve our property interest here. That's called a trade secret. So the lawsuit, in various ways, asks for a declaratory judgment to say that the contract in which the county pledged to pay $5 million for these electronic voting machines is void because the county couldn't, even with legislation, much less with a mere contract, take away the public's right to verify that its elections are being counted properly, or take away the public's right to observe the counting of the vote. Because ultimately, when you have secret vote counting, no election is credible. I mean, that's not just a statement. I think that's just a fact, that if somebody wants to say, I'm going to count these votes in secret and I'm never going to disclose what the ballots look like to you, that's simply not a credible election. And so the situation that we have in the United States right now is that with the vast majority of the vote being counted electronically, is that there's no basis for confidence in American elections. And anybody that really believes in democracy should and do find that situation intolerable, that there cannot be a situation where secret vote counting is allowed. So that was the basic intent of the lawsuit, is, you know, against secret vote counting, but using the particular tactic of questioning the contract to purchase. Other people have taken different approaches, saying the machines shouldn't have been certified or things like that. You know, all these approaches, I think, are reasonable. So at the time, we first met here on your show, Mike, we had just filed. And shortly after that, Sequoia, who is the manufacturer of the voting machines in Snohomish County, tried to remove the lawsuit to federal court. And there was a big battle in federal court, and the federal judge agreed with us completely and sent it back down to state court. So in terms of all the motions in the case so far, we've won them all. And then on March 24th, coming up, there's going to be cross motions by both sides, and we'll both be seeking to win the case prior to trial. So we're looking for some activity on March 24th that should be pretty interesting.
And what is the final result that you would be happy with, besides just winning? I mean, what specifically are you looking for?
Well, the relief in the lawsuit was, number one, a declaration that these constitutional principles have been violated, for the court to make that declaration. Number two, to void the contract. Number three, for Sequoia, because the contract has been voided out, to return the money to the taxpayers of the $5 million. Now, Sequoia, by a vote, 3-2 vote of the Snohomish County Council, is their machines are no longer going to be used in Snohomish County, because Snohomish County has voted to go to vote by mail. And that's due to, you know, a lot of different factors and a lot of people pushing for vote by mail for a lot of different reasons. But nevertheless, you know, the demise of electronic voting in Snohomish County, for the time being anyway, is very, very good news. So that's the general relief we sought. Now that they're no longer, as of September, going to be used in elections, what that means is, you know, we still have the anti-secrecy issues, the declaratory judgment alive. We still can void out the contract. However, in terms of preventing their use in future elections, that's been achieved for now.
So in your case, would that be precedent-setting in terms of being able to use it across the United States?
No, in terms of precedent, what we learn in law school is that it has to go up to an appellate court before and be published, actually. Not all appellate decisions are published. And then it is precedent setting within the jurisdiction in which that appellate court has authority. So it can be very influential. I mean, it can be, you know, certainly if there is a written decision, it's going to be circulated all over the country and people are going to, you know, forward it and use it as what's called persuasive authority. But it won't be binding. But I think that's okay, though, because I don't want to bind anybody. I want to persuade them, actually, based on what they already believe, that, you know, secret vote counting is wrong. I don't want to force anybody to believe that. That takes all the fun out of it. I mean, I think when we all come together and we're sort of against secret vote counting, that really means we're for, you know, democracy. We're for, you know, the dignity of each person that's inherent in each person having the same equal vote, the same ballot. You know, ballots in a way are kind of like souls. Everybody's got one. You can't take it away, and they're all equal. And so there's a certain equality and even if you really want to push the issue, even a spirituality in the notion of ballot and being similar. Similar to a soul. And I think that is one of the fundamental reasons why I think what we're going to see in the next 10 or 20 years is a reversal of opinion on this whole idea of taking away people's right to vote based on a felony conviction or something like that. It's as absurd as taking away somebody's soul. I mean, you wouldn't even attempt to do that. It's crazy. And the reason, and, you know, an additional reason not to take away anybody's right to vote even upon conviction, is because it's really, in the terms of even the way the founders thought, it's a protection for all of us against tyranny. Because if a conviction, whether it be legitimate or illegitimate, takes away somebody's right to vote, it's an easy thing to, you know, change the election by 1, 2, 3, 4% by jailing 1, 2, 3, or 4% of the population. So when everybody retains their right to vote, there's a check and balance against the government from becoming too tyrannical. And so it's not a sort of a welfare program for felons or something like that, why we would want to retain the right to vote for felons. I want them to have the right to vote because it's a check and balance against tyranny, and that protects us all, you know, among other reasons. You know, that's a reason to do that. So I think when people start to, you know, rediscover their heritage and what ballots are all about, I think there's going to be this shift in opinion on felony disenfranchisement.
And Sequoia is one of three large companies that supplies a lot of counties in the U.S. with electronic voting machines?
Yeah, they're one of the big three, with ESNS and Diebold being two others.
And what's your sense for how many other counties and or states are currently using the electronic machines?
You mean nationally or in the state of Washington?
Well, both.
Well, in the state of Washington in 2004, there were two counties that used what are called DREs, or direct recording electronic voting technologies, or touchscreens, Yakima and Snohomish. There are now zero counties in Washington state using DRE or touchscreen technology. Except for, you know, voting for the disabled, there are a few counties that have picked up DREs for the purpose of allowing people that are disabled to vote, which, you know, if somebody cannot execute a ballot without assistance, it is appropriate for those people to have assistance. And if there's a technology that can do that, that's fine. But under normal circumstances, you know, nothing should become between a voter and their ballot, particularly an interface like a computer where the voter then is not allowed to ever see their ballot. So anyway, there are now presently zero counties with that. I think that's a success worth noting. I think it's the best nationally. But the people that are in favor of DREs are pressing. They want to get them back in the game through early voting and using DREs in early voting. And they'll certainly still be trying to pitch any county willing to listen to purchase the technology. So we need to celebrate the status of things now, but you know, keep our eyes open for the future.
And how did the Help America Vote Act affect the integration of electronic voting machines? Was that something that was supportive of bringing more electronic voting machines into counties across the country, or?
Yeah, the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, H-A-V-A, provided billions and billions of dollars in federal pork barrel money to suddenly change all these voting machines. The impetus or the momentum was ostensibly the 2000 election with the hanging chads in Florida. And the whole problem, as everybody recalls, of the hanging chad is, in a few marginal cases, it's really ambiguous in terms of what did the voter really intend. And, you know, and that is a problem, especially in a close election. But, you know, there are very, very few ballots when you look at the big picture that really had that problem. However, the solution to having ambiguous evidence is not to eliminate the evidence. And that's what HAVA does with electronic voting. We don't have hanging chads anymore, and you have election officials who have purchased these things around the country bragging that they've solved the problem of the hanging chads. Yeah, by eliminating the evidence. I mean, it is absurd in, you know, instituting secret vote counting. So, you know, there's a sort of a joinder, I guess, if you will, between government officials who run elections and vendors, both of whom tend to have reasons to love DRE, electronic voting technology, that have nothing to do with what the public's interests are. But it's understandable. I'm not trying to be truly critical, but I mean, the corporate vendor, for example, wants to avoid criticism of their product or allegations that it was defective in elections. They want with all their heart and soul to make a lot of money and have a good reputation. So they like secret vote counting because it'll cover up any flaws and make their product seem magical. For similar but different reasons, election officials like it because they don't want to be in the fishbowl. We all saw that here in the state of Washington with the recount. All the elections officials were in this incredible media fishbowl in which all of their actions were guessed, second guessed, and third guessed. No rational human being really wants that kind of thing. And yet, so even though it's understandable that these election officials don't want that kind of intense accountability, we need that kind of intense accountability. The public must have that kind of intense accountability. So while I feel for elections officials and I think that they're acting understandably, it's not appropriate in the most public arena possible in our society, which is elections.
And what are your thoughts on the mail-in ballots? I mean, in a way, and I think King County is going to that as well, but in many ways, that doesn't appear transparent at all.
Well, with the mail-in ballots, yeah, it all depends. It's really not a question of what technology you are using, although I would say that if it is touchscreen technology, that is a system that cannot be rescued. There is no reform that can be made to it. If you're using optical scanning, you have the potential for a fair and reasonable system, but it has to be combined. The paper ballots that are then optically scanned have to be combined with the appropriate checks and balances in the system. So any system that, for example, uses paper ballots but doesn't have the other appropriate checks and balances can give paper ballots a bad name. And so when you're out there talking to people about elections, you'll oftentimes hear, well, you know, there's a long history of fraud and abuse in elections in the U.S., and those were all paper ballots. Very, very true. But, you know, it's the real system is paper ballots with the appropriate checks and balances. And when that is used, which, you know, is not certainly not all the time, it's probably a minority of the time, that is the best system we have. Now, there's not going to be a perfect system. And the reason is because there's so much at stake in elections that there are always thousands, if not millions and millions of people with a motivation to try to game the system or somehow, you know, tip the scales in their favor. You know, with trillions at stake in the federal budget, billions in pork barrel projects and government contracts, millions in individual congressional and senatorial campaigns, life and death issues, you know, some people that can't imagine life, you know, without the right to choose, and other people that can't imagine, you know, continuing on with abortions in this country. I mean, there are thousands, if not millions, of people who would feel great about changing the election in order to make sure that the right thing happens. So, you know, there's really so much incentive there. I mean, everybody virtually has a motive. Everybody that votes is biased for one candidate or the other. They cast a ballot. They chose a side. So there's nobody in elections that can really be trusted. And I think that's a really key point, is that the system is based on checks and balances, which is founded on the idea that we don't trust. What we do is we have it open and we observe each other. But politicians oftentimes like to talk in terms of how do we restore public trust. It's inappropriate. That's an inappropriate question. The only trust that's appropriate is the trust that comes because it's wide open and we've got mutually opposed parties watching each other like hawks. Then we can trust, but that's not true trust. You know, in other words, we shouldn't take anything on blind faith with elections. We should be there to verify that it's all on the up and up, because ultimately, to have confidence in the system, another buzzword, the loser is the one, you know, it's never a problem for the winner to have confidence. So the only perspective that really matters is, does the loser believe that they lost by a fair and equitable process? If they do, that's great. But if they don't, then you're just undermining the system. So there's no point in having anything but a wide open checks and balances type of election system. And the way that you tell a good system from a bad system of voting is, how big are the rewards for people that do try to game the system, and they always will, and do attempts to cheat or defraud the system create evidence or witnesses? With paper ballots, with each act of fraud, you get one lousy vote, which is very, very rare to affect a thing, and that's one crime, and it creates evidence and witnesses. We had a trial in Wenatchee about the absentee ballots exclusively. It wasn't about electronic voting. They didn't do anything on that because there's no evidence. Okay, whereas with electronic voting, one person can throw the whole election, and if they're good at all, create no evidence that they've altered the totals. And there was even a public demonstration of that with a Diebold machine a few weeks ago by Harry Hursti, a Finnish computer scientist working with black box voting. So, again, the test is, how big is the payoff for a given act of fraud? With paper ballots, it's small, tends to be very small. And with electronic, you can throw a whole election, one person can do that. And then also, you know, does it leave evidence and witnesses? With paper ballots, there are evidence and witnesses. With electronic voting, essentially, there's no evidence. So that's I think, how you tell a good voting system from a bad voting system. And I think that, you know, that's a critical point, because, you know, people always bring up criticisms of paper ballots, and it creates the impression that paper ballots have problems just like electronic voting, so it's all kind of equal. They're all bad. That's not the case at all.
Talk about one of the proposed technical fixes, which is the paper trail. Do you see that as a legitimate fix?
Well, in virtually all cases, no. Well, no, in all cases, no. Because first of all, the paper trail, if it's just a paper trail, it can just be ignored. First of all, the paper that's created has to have an importance. It should be the ballot of record. But if it's the ballot of record, then basically the computers are just being used as expensive ballot printers. And that's a waste of taxpayers' money. Basically, you're trying to take a paper ballot system and paste it on top of a expensive computer system. And that's just, you know, inefficient. Here's the interesting thing, though, about electronic voting or any kind of voting where you use booths for voting. You know, there are a lot of games played in Ohio with the distribution of voting machines. You know, if it was a Republican district, they'd get plenty of machines. If it was a Democratic district, they'd be shorted on the machines. And that's one way that you can game the system and get quite a few votes without, you know, necessarily engaging in quote-unquote crimes, at least, you know, in some people's point of view. But let's just say that the proponents of electronic voting achieve everything. Their wildest dreams come true. You know, everybody in the country gets electronic voting through Havon, stuff like that, and everybody's voting on touchscreen DREs. What you've got is you're just, even if their dreams come true, you're just replicating the situation that you have in many school districts around the country, where the rich school districts have plenty of resources and the kids are well taught, and the poor school districts have fewer resources. So in the poorest counties, they're not going to be able to afford as many machines. Those voters will stand in lines because these electronic voting machines are expensive bottlenecks. And that's what you're seeing around the country, is that people have to stand in line like never before in order to go to these newfangled machines. There's not really enough money out there to provide convenience. Whereas with a paper ballot, you can vote that on your lap, you can put it up against the wall. You know, you don't need to stand in line for anywhere near as long with a paper ballot like you do with electronic voting. So if we would simply demand a 5-minute service guarantee, electronic voting would be finished. You know, so maybe if you like secret elections, then I would suggest to you, you probably don't like standing in line. And so, you know, you should just demand a 5-minute service guarantee from your local elections officials.
So give us a sense for where we are nationally with fixing, repairing our voting systems.
Well, we're just starting to peek through. There's one case that is... made it up to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it's probably not going to be granted cert. So, but there are many different litigation cases around the country. Just a couple weeks ago, the Washington Post did the first national article on the dangers of or the actual demonstration of a hack of electronic voting. That's the Harry Hursti, Hursti hack of the Diebold machine, in which he was able to change the vote from I believe it was 4-3 to 6-1 or something like that, with no evidence being left behind. Each state is a different story because elections are a state-by-state thing, so there's a lot of different details in different states. But momentum is building, and I think if we stay away from the technical details except where needed and stay centered on what the really core issues are, no secret counting, no lines, you know, good service, and remembering that in a democracy, the key thing about a democracy is not elections. You know, Aristotle actually thought that elections were a sign of aristocracy, not democracy, interestingly enough. But a democracy, the real unique thing about that is that the people are considered to be in charge, that the people are the only legitimate source of all political power. And the only mechanism for that power to be transferred to the government is through elections. And so if the government, who administers those elections, you can see the government has a conflict of interest here because they're getting their money and power from elections, and yet they're running the elections. And if the government combines with some kind of vendor or anybody or does it themselves and says, okay, we're going to count these votes in secret, these votes where power is being transferred from the public to the government, you know, I talked about having no basis for confidence or having no credibility. I mean, that is truly an outrageous proposal when you really stay centered on what democracy really is, the people in charge. So the people in charge have the right to supervise their own elections. Otherwise, they're not really in charge. I mean, if we can't tell our elections officials, hey, we want to check out to make sure this election is legitimate, it's not a democracy, period. But nationally, there's a lot of hopeful things going on. Momentum is building. The story's different in each state, and some things are just starting to poke through nationally right now.
All right. Well, where do you recommend people get involved in this issue? Obviously, you have a significant date of March 24th coming up in your case.
Right. Well, right now, there's in Washington State, there's a bill, I believe it's HB 2532, which is trying to institute audits of elections, and people can contact their legislators and urge support for HB 2532, and so that we can plug a hole in the paper trail legislation that was passed last year, and that hole was, you know, the lack of any rigorous auditing system. One of the key things, one of the key checks and balances that would really be good is to have what are called mandatory manual recounts prior to the announcement of the first results. One way you can do it, for example, is if all of the ballots are, you know, together and they're kind of randomized, and you take certain samples and statisticians can tell you whether it needs to be 1% or 2% or what, and just hand count, have like two or three groups of hand counters, hand counting random samples like that. All of them, the hand counters and the machines, should come out within statistical error about the same. And if they don't, then you know we have a problem, and you shouldn't announce the results in the first place until you figure out exactly what the problem is. And notice with that kind of a system, even though we're using technology, optical scans, The hand counters are checking to make sure that the optical scan, in effect, they're checking to make sure the optical scan isn't malfunctioning in some way. And even if the one group of hand counters has been corrupted or makes a mistake, they're not going to match the other hand counters. So with a checks and balances system like that, you can create a much higher degree of reliability in an election system than you otherwise would. So having audits and having what are called mandatory manual recounts before the announcement of the results is really important, because once a result or an expectation is created, then of course anybody that tries to challenge that is immediately called the sore loser and stuff like that. So it's really important to get it right the first time and to say, hey, you know, the public and the media should be willing to wait, if need be, another couple days. It's not going to be that long, but wait till the morning after the election, you know, to get results. It's, you know, we've tolerated a campaign season for well over a year. Another day is not going to be a problem.
And specifically with the facilities, the buildings where they're doing the counting, the tabulating, things like that, it's reasonable to expect that the public should be able to go into these facilities and watch the process as it's happening?
Yeah, if you look at the Washington statutes, you know, there are public rights to observe the counting. Now, the problem is that through policies and administrative procedures, you know, they've tended to create distance, you know, such that you can't really see what the ballots are actually, you know, you can watch people count, but, you know, you could perhaps see them if they were going to light a bonfire with ballots, but, you know, it's hard to see exactly what's going on. In the Supreme Court, in the Washington Supreme Court, one of the things the Democrats wanted to do is they wanted to be close enough to be actually be able to see how those ballots were being counted. And the Supreme Court did not uphold that particular right because they didn't see that it was spelled out anywhere. And they thought that the administrative convenience of the elections officials to have their counters not be, quote-unquote, interfered with, you know, trumped the right to have a very meaningful observation. But again, I think that that kind of result can change once people, you know, realize what elections are really all about and realize the importance of, you know, public control of those elections.
All right. We're just about out of time. What resources do you recommend people turn to, for instance, websites, books, anything like that?
Well, there's a lot of books coming out. There's a few movies that are about to be released, but some good websites include votersunite.org. Of course, there's blackboxvoting.org is also based here in the Seattle area. In fact, you know, a lot of the key organizations are actually here in the state of Washington, you know, surprisingly. There's also several books that have come out. You know, Tom Hartman has a book. There's a book called Deliver the Vote. There's one by Andrew Gumbel. I think Mark Crispin Miller's book is a really good one about the 2004 election, because he rigorously catalogs quite a bit of the evidence regarding the 2004 election. So there's all those things. But I think the most important thing is that even though there is, in fact, lots of indirect evidence, and the you know, the exit polls on their face indicate that Kerry won by several million votes. The main thing is that activists have been warning for years that, hey, don't go with this electronic voting because you can alter election and there will be no evidence. And now some people in the media are saying, but you've got no evidence. And the media needs to wake up and say, we've been telling you for a long time that this is why you don't do it, because it very well may create no evidence. So, you know, and yet they're turning around and saying, hey, you've got no evidence. Well, you know, there's the exit polls. There's lots of evidence. Look at Mark Crispin Miller's book and go from there.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
We've just been talking with Paul Leto. He is an Everett-based business law and consumer law attorney. And again, some of those sites you can check out are blackboxvoting.org and votersunite.org.